Welcome to the Eco News Report. I'm your host this week, Tom Wheeler, the Executive Director of the Environmental Protection Information Center, and I'm joined by my co-host and friends, Larry Glass of the North Coast Environmental Center. Hey, Larry.
Hey, Tom.
Scott Greeson of Friends of the Elk River.
Hey, Tom.
Jen Kalt of Humboldt Baykeeper.
Hello.
And my best friend of all, Jerry Martine, local poet, activist, and I'm not sure what other sort of monikers you want to add to yourself.
That's probably enough.
All right.
I'm sure other people will figure out something to add.
So this is a little bit of a different show for us, and I think that this is going to be a really fun one because we get to embrace our creative side, think about the intersection of art and the environment, activism, and art. I know Jerry has a number of poems that he wants to read, but first off, let's talk about how this poetry came to be, these poems that you want to read for us today.
Yeah, I wanted to share some of the experience of collaborating with an old friend and a local artist, Becky Evans, who proposed that we work together in a show that was at Beyonce Gallery last year, where poets and visual artists paired up. I had never done anything like that on purpose. It was interesting the way it came out, and then we got together and talked about it and figured out that we had come to be called environmental artists. So that's a big label for people who just care about the place they live, but that's basically it. And a lot of the reason for our deep care is because we both grew up in Southern California and saw a lot of what we cared about disappear. And we're determined as much as possible not to have that happen here. And that kind of came out in, I wrote a long piece about water and power and the history of water in Southern California, and which is a battle I'm still fighting with my local services district. So it was pretty easy to transfer the message. And unfortunately, some of the same pressures of what are called development and improvement are still going on, and it's hard to tell people here who grew up here what it is they have to lose. I would not have believed what happened to Southern California could have happened, but having witnessed it, I feel like I'm some kind of a convert who has to go out and rant and rave to the unconverted. So then when Piante proposed for its last show that Becky and I again collaborate and do something and fill the whole gallery with stuff, I said, oh, well, sure. But I had no idea how many poems does it take to fill half of a gallery, and how does a poem get from the page to a wall? And that all turned out to be very educational.
Didn't the Beatles ask that question?
How
many holes does it take to fill the Albert Hall?
Yeah,
they did ask.
The Beatles, I think, got there first. There were other collaborators in this, which is chiefly Alderon Laird, who's been tracking sea level rise around the bay. The reason Becky wanted to collaborate with me is because she had already been doing some paintings from the little booklet of poems Before the Flood, which came mostly out of my walking around Humboldt Bay, and especially this little spit of land that sticks out into the bay where Elk River empties its sediment load.
Right.
So those poems led to some of her paintings, and then it evolved into Becky and her partner Bob and Alderon and I walking out on Elk River Spit and doing some exploring. That ended up being, for me, the most interesting and the best piece that came out of this, which, like the collection of poems Before the Flood, is a far distance from what I originally, and I guess most people think of as nature poetry. You can't spend much time around Humboldt Bay without seeing the disastrous wreckage and learning some of the awful history that we all live with and drive past every day and walk over every day. So all of that came in there. So it's the beauty of that the poem see is in spite of what we've done here. And it suggests that ways that maybe we look at all of it, and that we look at it as artists and poets and water scientists and in terms of whatever it is that we're doing here, and see a larger collaboration. I think the theme of collaboration is chiefly what came out of that, because I think collaboration is a good word for what we're going to need to get through what's coming. Let me just start with the first poem in this book, Before the Flood. weather report. It was going to rain, but the forecast changed. Scattered light with clouds of glory. An 8-foot tide, the bay swollen full, the river bank to bank, this narrow spit between. A man and a dog, a faint trail, the book of Revelations open on the sand. A marsh wren flies ahead, this way to the rapture. Dunes and beach grass, and on a driftwood log, four ravens holding the world together. Southerly breeze, gusts to 15 knots. He throws a stick out into the everlasting sky. The dog brings it back. So that's simply an accounting of walking the dog. I'm out there several times a week with our dog Maggie, who's saving my health and improving my connection with the natural world.
Forgive me if this is too intrusive, but did you grow up in a Christian or Catholic household? There is so much biblical imagery.
Yeah, that is strange. My mother tried to bring me up as a Catholic, but it didn't.
It didn't stick with me either.
It didn't stick. It was good for a while until I got to the question in catechism, where is God? And you know the answer to that? God is everywhere. Well, what am I doing here? And this, you know, getting my knuckles wrapped by the nuns. And so I think that turned me into a pantheist right away and a nature lover. But a lot of the vocabulary, plus, you know, a great deal of reading in the literature of England. Strange. I was a physics major because I thought I'd be able to. But it turned out that there was a lot of calculus between me and that vision. So it turned out I'm a good reader, you know. So I became an English major and just sort of followed that until it led to, you know, you never know where you're going to go if you don't stop and look around. But it did supply me with a lot of language that I try to put it to the best use I can. I mean, I guess we're all trying to use whatever skills we have on behalf of, you know, the best things that we, the things that we love and want to see and stay around. Here's another one from Elk River, a little ways upstream. I guess everybody can still remember a few years ago we had a little drought and it didn't rain until spring. It was really, really dry. So it wasn't until Valentine's Day that there was enough water for a salmon to get up Elk River. And they practically had to walk upriver, late spawn. A shade of red, deeper than the heart's blood, waiting all winter for last night's little rain. Barely enough to swim in. Fallen alders block the current. Gravel buried under sediment. Because we failed to love this river. She brushes the bottom with her tail. A cloud of silt drifts downstream. He charges up the rocky shallows, waits for her in a muddy pool. Maybe it was the ring around the moon told them it was time. Or maybe it was our talk last night about stopping upstream logging. I say to the salmon what a hydrologist said to me. There's good gravel in the upper little South Fork. We are old, and it's a long way to go. Tonight's forecast is desire, changing to a light rain. Bless the salmon. Hope they do well. I've checked today. There's still not enough water for a coho in Elk River, but maybe it'll rain enough this week. Let me read a third poem from this little collection of poems about the bay, and then I'll read some pieces that came together around. It's strange that the booklet generated paintings and then the paintings generated poems. So this collaboration is a very strange thing, and the interweaving of the arts and poetry and science, they're not as separate things as we usually think they are. They're all different tools for looking at the world and trying to tell people what we found and what's there. And this poem is dedicated to somebody who really devoted his life to that, Mel McKinney. If you ever went to a meeting that had to do with Humboldt Bay, Mel was there. And he always had his facts together, and he always had his hat on. He's nicknamed Cappy.
I'm so glad you're evoking him now, Jerry, because when you started talking about that spit at the mouth of the Elk River, I instantly thought of Cap.
All right. No, I mean, if you walk around the new Hickshory Bayside Trail, there's a little sub trail named after Mel, the Mel McKinney Loop. This is called Gone to Glory. Here he is, more of this kind of biblical. I mean, the Bible's full of great stories, I guess, and I think those still inform our imagination and provide great metaphors for what the natural world is like. Read the Song of Solomon. It's a completely pagan poem, a beautiful piece of work. Gone to Glory for Mel McKinney. You have to wonder why they do it. Calistegia soldanella spread across the dunes. 1,000 tiny pink and white Victrola horns playing a scratchy old 78 of the Ode to Joy. With rotten pilings, chunks of broken concrete, homeless sleeping bags, rusty tanks and boilers, all of it singing along. The river's at low tide this morning, a muddy stream between muddy banks. The coastal hills, expensive, ugly houses, trees like bad haircuts. God knows why. They're all singing, too. Even the sand and silt we're standing on, which should be out in the ocean or up in those hills holding the forest together, gives out a hallelujah chorus of gray-green artemisia. Stones on the beach, clouds in the sky, kicked around, blown away, the spirit still singing. A Coast Guard cutter on the bay is practicing a rescue. Over on the waterfront, cops are seeking people of interest. In the courthouse, officials are looking for more places to develop. The little ship goes round and round in circles. From the dunes, we cheer them on. Rescue everyone you can, boys and girls. Fix all you can that's broken. But listen to what the morning glories are singing. Nobody knows why, but it's all been saved. Yeah, a great model. I mean, he worked at the pulp mills for a long time, I think. And when he retired, he decided to take up fishing, but then stopped because he began learning about what's in the bay. And say, wait a minute, he wanted a place he could catch fish and eat them. Not a lot to ask, But.
Yeah, he told me a lot of what I know about the history of the bay before most people that are alive now came here, and he told me about the union breaking strike at the mill that is now the Bayshore Mall, and he told me about how when the tsunami of 1964 arrived from the earthquake in Alaska, it destroyed a bunch of Crescent City, but it also impacted the bay such that the water all rushed out, and then there were boats laying on their sides on the bottom of the bay, and then the water came back in. He was working at the Simpson Plywood Mill in Fairhaven at that time.
Wow.
I miss that guy.
Yeah.
Every time something comes up, like Waterfront Drive extension, oh my God, they're going to try and do this again. Oh,
right. Yeah.
What would Mel say if he was here?
Exactly.
His last public hearing was the hearing in 2012 when they voted against that.
The ghost of Mel McKinney will prevent that ever happening.
Yeah.
He certainly inspires me to keep fighting.
Yeah.
Yeah, good. Yeah, he lives on with all of us. And, it's a good thing because, as we've all learned, bad ideas never die.
Well, not in Eureka.
They go underneath Eureka, and then they emerge somewhere else, and somebody else think, hey, let's try again and punch that road through there. Bad ideas.
Jerry, you were talking about your poetry as a strange kind of nature poetry. Like, you're talking about recognizing, seeing, kind of with a whole heart, both the damage and the beauty. And it struck me when you were saying that, how much your vision reminds me of a great landscape photographer I've long admired, Edward Bertinsky, who takes these great large format pictures of terrible things, acid lakes, tankers getting broken up on the sands of Bangladesh. There's some of his topics, rail trains. It's beautiful, beautiful work, but it also talks about something inescapable in the situation we've created.
Yeah, I think that's got to be in our art, too. I mean, you can't just say, well, let's not look at it and let's only write about parks or... or imaginary places and let the real places go to hell. I mean, that's that won't do. I mean, if we're going to keep living on this planet, which, you know,
it's kind of an F, yeah,
up for grabs these days.
You're listening to the Eco News Report. Jerry Martin, local poet, is joining us on the show today, and we have some poetry for you.
So, yeah, I want to keep emphasizing, I guess, and sharing, I guess, for this time of year, it's important for everybody. It's sort of, we all go indoors and kind of withdraw and sit by our fires and rekindle our spirits and rekindle community and our commitment to whatever it is we're running around doing the rest of the year. But we need to, this time of year, sit down and recharge and recollect our forces and reimagine, I think, what we're going to be doing in the coming year. And, you know, and that includes the beauty as well as the things we want to protest. And we need to change some stuff. We need to radically change some stuff. And I think people need to learn the meaning of the word radical. You know, it's in the word radish, and it means roots. I'm losing a lot of friends recently, and I have a great poet friend who wrote a beautiful love poem, but he says, love is not a flower. Love is a root, you know, and we need to think about where we're coming from. And, you know, it ain't heaven. You know, it's the forces of life come from below. And they're the ones that we've tried to banish from our lives and from our civilization and pave it over. But, you know, that's not going to happen. So here's another river poem. This was what started this when we got into this collaboration. I had already said, oh, sure, I'll do that. And I said, oh, by the way, this needs to be all recent poetry. And I said, oh, are you kidding? I mean, it was like 6 months away, which is seemed, you know, maybe more, but still, I don't work that fast, and I revise a lot. So I started. Well, let me dig through and see what I have that I can fix that might be, you know, things that I've given up on or set aside. And this is a piece that was originally written about the mouth of the Mattole. And one of the puzzles of being in an art show with poetry is, oh, how do I put this on the wall and make it look interesting? So this poem is shaped, you know, kind of like the Mattole estuary. That's a cheap trick, I guess. You can do it with the typography and stuff, but still, it got me to finish this poem. And it really isn't as much a visual poem as it's a reading poem. So I'm really happy.
And for the listener's benefit, what Jerry just showed us is a sort of a meandering funnel shape.
Yeah,
bigger at the top than it is at the bottom.
The words are kind of shaped on the page like the Mattole estuary. This is called River Mouth. Taking mouth in its literal sense, river mouth. Listen, you gravel-extracting, dioxin-leaking, cash-cropping, clear-cutting, meter-misreading, underdeveloping, bottle-sucking water baby, I've had it up to here, you damn my flow, divert my one desire, silt me in, scour me out, pump me dry, take my trees, leave no shade, no summer pool, you haven't been returning my messages, I'm choking on the runoff of your bad decisions, so sorry about your underwater investments, but my flood is like your chapter 11, honey. I'm liquidating our relationship.
Other than that, everything's fine.
Yeah, right. That river mouth. You know. Yeah, if rivers could talk.
Got a little to say.
That's what they would say. And then, I don't know, I'm turning to a more solemn note in some of the news from the news about, the show is called Water and Power, which came from the name of the first poem that I wrote when Becky and I first collaborated, and it seemed appropriate in lots of ways, and not only water in all of its forms, but power in all of its forms. And it seemed to me that we could not talk about water and the bay without having something in there that acknowledged the Wiat history and Wiat ecology and their place in our lives. and to acknowledge that. And this again was taken from some words for a ceremony when regular February ceremonies were being conducted to commemorate the Indian Island Massacre of 1860. That evolved over the years until it's not just a memory of the terrible things that happened, but a gathering and a resurgence of the Wiat people's energies and their lives here, and a restatement, you know, saying, you know, I mean, they're still here, and that life is still here. And this poem, as I was working on this, the whole ceremony, the public acknowledgement took place where the city of Eureka returned that property, and maybe the Indian Island name became, maybe for good, something like its original Wiat name, the name of that place, Tulawat. And I've begun to notice that here and there, like Monument Ridge, that a lot of Wiat names are reemerging, and it changes the way we see things. If that ridge is just called Monument Ridge, or if it's like most of the places around here are no-name place, you know, it's like, oh, wait a minute, that place had a name, you know, and it gives it like the idea of the Klamath now having personhood. Well, yeah. Well, it's a belated realization. So this is Tulawat. The tide comes in, swells the sloughs and marshes, then rushes out like 100 rivers. As timely as the moon, life's daily expenses are paid for. Bay clam, eelgrass, the gills of perch, take in the water, let it through. Everything taken care of. Nobody keeps anything for long. People made crazy by money have to learn again and again. For everything taken, you give something back. What could be more simple? They log the woods, can the salmon, sell the lots. When the bills come due, the big shots disappear. Land and people stay and pay. We've come to another change of tides. Coastal real estate and consumer confidence taking a plunge. People still here, some of us will remain. For every basket, bead, and bone, the bills are still outstanding. We make a small offering of words and fire and memory. Please apply it to the balance. And I mean balance in every sense. So my mother worked as a bookkeeper and never had enough money to keep our household finances quite balanced. So maybe that makes me write books about money as well as books of poetry. That seems like kind of a bookkeeper's poem. But I think that kind of accounting, historical and spiritual and moral accounting, you know, I mean, it has to happen. I mean, that's the kind of thing we try to do with environmental legislation and environmentalism itself. I mean, I wish we had all thrown that word away when it first appeared and got stuck on us, you know, like being called an environmentalist. I mean, just because you care about the place you live. It's like, I breathe, so I'm an aorist, you know.
Is there a better word you'd apply to your own relationship to the world?
Ecology, I think, is, I mean, it's a less familiar word, and it means something. It's about the science of seeing whole things, you know, like everything is connected. Well, yeah, people don't want to see that, of course. Especially, you know, don't get me started. You have got me started. See, like, this
the whole
happening.
Point here was to get you started.
Really? Yeah. So that is part of the lesson of collaboration, is learning to see that everything is connected and that nothing goes away but comes back in some form or other, and that includes us. I mean, that we are connected, and we are at our greatest state of disconnection now, I think, that human beings have ever noticed. Not just between the very wealthy and the very poor, but between the civilized, paved over, concrete, non-living grid that we've put down in order to, just because we think that's the way we have to live. And it's not at all. I mean, just look at the concrete cracks and seeds come up, and that's got to happen. And we'll learn the lesson that everything's connected, or we won't. In this last piece, this kind of long little story about, and it came out of that trip I was discussing on our walk out onto Elk River Spit. We went out to look at there's a little pond out there that Alderon Laird had been studying for some time, trying to figure out, well, this is an anomalous thing. Out here in the middle of all this salt water on this sand spit, which used to be very much smaller, and it got a lot larger in like the 1930s and 40s. I learned from him after I had written the little book of poems about Elk River Spit that a lot of it came from Boone Point, from our changing of the bay, so the tidewaters swept away a huge amount of Boone Point, and a lot of it ended up being Elk River Spit. So it's like this place that you walk out there and you think of it as solid land and say, wow, this is all very fluid. And now they're finding, well, and at high tide, of course, we're walking out there like last week, the surf was coming over it. And it's going to do that more often. And maybe it'll keep building up. Humboldt Redwoods is supplying it with a steady load of sediment to wash down the river, so maybe that will keep it in place, but I don't know if it's going to be enough. I think the water quality people have forced them to cut back, you know. Well, we won't go there now. So, but this also, again, like the piece about Humboldt Bay and all the junk around it, trying to see what is going to redeem our history here. You know, when people look back on this time and think about our lives here and what we did here and what we did not do, it would be nice if we could try to find some bit of, here I go again, redemption. Not homeless. At the end of this little known world, there's a spring. A homeless guy lived there, beside the pond between the river and the bay. He had a cat. 10,000 years ago, when the ice was melting, the ocean still miles away, legend says the spring was already here. And then it was under the bay. And now it comes up through this spit of sand that appeared less than a century ago. It isn't Walden Pond, a stone's throw wide, fringed with cattail, willow, myrtle. Frogs, raccoons, summer blackbirds also shelter here. He toughed it out for a couple of years, cut back trees with a little axe, shoveled sand against the December tides. In a battered aluminum boat, he ferried Eureka's lost and cast-off treasure to his little outpost. An American flag flew from the big black pipe that vents the city's sewage outfall at the edge of the bay. Home is belongings. His house was a Kmart tent, on sand and mud that's sinking beside a freshwater pond, floating on seawater that's rising. People tried to help him, show him woodcraft, how to smoke the fish he caught. Someone even tried to rescue his cat, meowing in the willows. Messages in chalk began appearing on the paved waterfront trail. Do not take cat. Cat not homeless. The man was homeless, but the cat was not. When the cat disappeared again and did not come back, he got two pit bulls that attacked several people and had to be put down. This brought him to the attention of the authorities, and then he was gone. Taken, maybe. Car batteries, tons of trash remained, the flag still flying in the southerly breeze. Eventually, people cleaned it up. Rangers, beach walkers, other homeless. Maybe that redeems a little our collective failure to do for the man what the man tried to do for a cat. It will take time for the pond to recover. It might be underwater, or it may keep rising from the bay. Home is belongings to one another, to crazy hope, to the earth. At the end of the world, there's a spring. Yeah, let me read one more piece for the winter and for the forest. Before I started all this writing so much about water and power, I was obsessing over trees and forests. This poem comes from, oddly enough, driving along Highway 5 in Oregon. You go uphill, downhill. It's a great way to see the forests of Oregon, what the ones they haven't shaved down to ground level. this is for the trees, which means, you know, it's for us. We have a really ancient association with trees and people. We need to recall that for the forest. This is called To the Winter Sun. And it comes, again, here it is. This is an old creation story that says that the angels that worked on the task of creating the world, some of them decided they liked it here and didn't go. They stayed around to take care of what they had created. In this vision, I think, oh, well, maybe, where are they? Well, maybe the forests is what we're seeing. To the winter sun. There were on the morning of creation as many angels on earth as there one day would be trees. They had flown here from the sun, were sent by the sun to care for every form of life on earth, to watch over whatever crawled from the sea, what slithered from under rock, every creature that moved around the angels' feet, that walked or crept or scurried in their shadow while the angels watched and sang. 1,000,000 years went by. The sun rose and set. Tens of millions of years. The earth wobbled and spun. Seasons came and went. The angels put down roots. The creatures nested in the angels' hair and learned to fly as the angels flew. Clung to their feathered limbs. Walked on two legs and on four between them where they had taken root. Forests of angels giving shelter and food. Praying to heaven to send the bright rain. The dark wind. They do not fear the flood or fire or ice, do not forbid their fruit, never cease to be a garden, continue to go down into the blind earth and raise their limbs to heaven, to be evergreen, laurel and cedar, juniper, spruce and yew, or they give their fire back to the sky, yellow, magenta, alder, oak and maple, cottonwood, willow, all the colors thrown off. Their bare limbs a prayer, rising, returning. The forest is a choir of angels rooted in the earth. Walk among them on a winter day. Sing back the sun. Stay warm.
As Jerry says, you never know where you're going to go unless you stop and look around.
There we go. You've been listening to the Eco News Report. Jerry, thank you so much for joining us on our show. I think that this is a real special treat, and hopefully we can make this at least kind of an annual appearance. This can be our Christmas show.
Let's call it Solstice.
Solstice show, yeah. This is a nice present for folks. This has been the Eco News Report. Join us again next week on this time and station for more environmental news from the North Coast.